طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. Today we feature an in-depth interview with one of the most prodigious proponents of the Palestinian narrative, who just happens to be an Israeli historian. Of course, I'm talking about Ilan Pappe, whose major work, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, is a meticulously documented account of Israel's military assault on Palestine in 1948. In this interview today, Pappe discusses recent events and political issues in Palestine with Michael Spath of the Indiana Center for Middle East Peace.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Michael, and with anyone else who listens to us.
Politicians in the U.S. and in Israel who don't want to seriously deal with the Palestinians always fall back on the two-state solution, and then they change the subject quickly. We know that the reality in Palestine and Israel is that it's already one state, and it's a racist, settler, colonial state. You're involved in the One Democratic State campaign with our friend Jeff Halper. Where do things stand with the One Democratic State campaign now?
Well, the campaign is moving on successfully, I would say. More and more people are joining it. It is at the crucial moment now. We were always confident that Palestinian public opinion in particular and small sections of the Israeli Jewish public opinion and definitely progressive people around the world support the idea. I mean, that was something we knew we would build on. The issue now is how to dialogue with politicians, leaders, and so on the Palestinian side, who still almost religiously adhere to the two-state solution, but really don't have any counterplan to, for instance, the deal of the century of the Trump-Netanyahu administrations, or what one should call really the steal of the century. And so there's no counter deal. And so our big challenge now is how to tap into that kind of activity that has to be led and will be led, I'm sure, by the Palestinians first and foremost. And hopefully we will be able to recruit support and solidarity, not just from Jews around the world, which is relatively easy these days, but even from within the Israeli Jewish society, because after all, they would be part of the solution. They're not just part of the problem. So that's where we are now.
You raised a number of things just in what you had to say there. Let me pick up on at least one of them. Jeff always talks about the need for Palestinian leadership, and you referred to it as well. Yet when you talk to Palestinians, you get two different views, right? The first one is, yes, we're in. The only realistic way forward, given the present realities on the ground, is one democratic state. On the other hand, no, Israel and their international supporters can't be trusted, and it's going to be like an Oslo II. So we'll end up with the short end of the stick. Can you understand Palestinians' reluctance to sign on to One Democratic State campaign? And how do you overcome that hurdle?
First of all, I can fully sympathize with any apprehensions about anything Israelis are involved with. I think this is a particular one of the bitter lessons Palestinians learned from Oslo, when their representative body, the PLO, was going along with the so-called Israeli peace camp that really betrayed them from the very beginning and cheated and really used the PLO recognition of Israel in order to sterilize the Palestinian struggle and to enable Israel to continue the occupation by other means. So I'm not surprised that there is a lot of suspicion, and I can understand it. I think the only way of dealing with it is to make sure that people understand that when we talk about the one-state campaign, we are talking about the change of paradigm, not just from two states to one state. That's one of them. But the second change, or the second paradigm change that we're talking about, is from an idea that peace is based on a dialogue between two peace camps on both sides, an Israeli peace camp and a Palestinian peace camp, which is not what we are doing, to the paradigm that could have been seen in the struggle of the ANC against apartheid South Africa, where actually the Palestinian national movement is leading the way with its own understanding of what freedom and liberation, if you want, what the liberation project of Palestine means in the 21st century, and recruits Jewish members of the society in Israel to go along with them, like the same way that white people joined the ANC. So it's not just a question even of leadership that does not exist, and of course unity that does not exist on the Palestinian side. I think it is a different kind of liberation project, very much that in many ways continues the liberation project of Palestine that began in 1948, but one which is adapted to the realities of the 21st century, where the settler community is already a third generation, where there are already 6 to 7 million Jews to reckon with in historical Palestine. And all this has to be taken into account without undermining the basic idea of liberation, which is to liberate the Palestinians from more than a century of colonization, oppression, and dispossession.
I have a number of questions here, but I want to keep following up on your first answer. You said that it would be easy to get Jews around the world to buy into this. You know, that's not been my experience here in the U.S. Talk to me a little bit more about how, relatively speaking, easy it would be to get Jews to sign on, especially in these days, you put it.
Yeah, well, first of all, I compare it to the challenge we have in signing on Jews inside Israel. That's compared to this, it's an easy ride. But I do agree with you. I mean, exaggerated here, but my experience, especially with young Jews, with the young Jewish generation, including the young American Jewish generation, is that it's very difficult for conscientious, moral young people, and very, very much idealist young people, which idealism is very strong at a younger age, to identify with what Israel stands for, not just with Israeli policies, but with a very basic idea of Israel. Especially in this time of ours where information flows easily, you cannot hide anymore what's going on. And I can give you one example, which I think sort of it will explain maybe where I derive my optimism. Israel has a program called the Taglit Discovery. In this program, Israel brings young American Jews to Israel with the hope that after the visit, they would immigrate to Israel, give up their American Jewish identity and become Israelis. Now, in the past, these program included the trips to the West Bank, and a lot of the young American Jews who participated in these journeys came back and became activists for BDS in American campuses. Now, what Israel does now, it takes, I mean, before COVID-19, nobody comes. But before COVID-19, Israel used to take these young American Jews, do a very quick tour around Tel Aviv and ship them back to the airport, not to show them anything that might, you know, contradict what they have been told about Israel. I think that it's very difficult to maintain that kind of loyalty from Jews around the world when so much is exposed, so much is known about what is being done. And therefore, I'm more hopeful in making pathways into young Jews around the world. And I know it would be much more difficult to recruit a significant support inside the Jewish community in Israel for that idea.
I want you to talk to me a little bit about the so-called, what a name, huh? The Abraham Accords, Israel's normalization with the UAE and Bahrain. Israel strengthens its anti-Iran axis. Saudi's MBS is touted as a moderate. Trump and Netanyahu divert attention from their domestic troubles. And U.S. arms dealers expand their reach into the Middle East. In fact, I think I read that you believe this will result in a new arms race. And this, all the while, the Palestinians are left further isolated. In fact, Israel just announced the expansion of thousands of new settlements in Beit El and Har Gilo in the wake of the UAE announcement. Talk to us about the many levels, the many disturbing levels of this kind of deal. Yeah.
So, to be honest, some of it is not as new as it sounds, and sounds new because of the histrionics that both the Netanyahu and Trump administration gave it because of their own domestic problems. Israel made the peace with the Arab countries, which were and are much more important than the Emirates and Bahrain. And this is Jordan and Egypt. And the peace with Jordan and Egypt was much more crucial and much more destructive and negative in its impact on the Palestinians than the so-called Abraham Accord. So we need to put things within a certain perspective. I think it would be a bit different if Saudi Arabia would follow these two countries. But these two countries did not have a war with Israel. Israel maintained the economic relationship with these countries before. There's a lot of kind of drama produced around it, which covers the lack of any true significance, I would say, for that. And of course, it's been manipulated in order to pressure the Palestinians, telling them, you see, this is the final proof that no one wants to support you in the Arab world, and therefore you are missing yet another opportunity for peace. We're familiar with this discourse. Now, I don't think that this adds a particular pressure compared to everything that already has been happening. What I mean by this, that a silent support by MBS in Saudi Arabia to Israel is far more important than an official support from the Emirates. So I think that's one level that we should take into account. The second level is that whatever Israel does successfully with Arab countries so far away from it, in the end of the day, it doesn't change the reality on the ground, where 12 million people, more or less equally divided between Jews and Arabs, are living on the same space as settlers and natives, as occupiers and occupied, colonizers and colonized. Nothing of the Abraham Accord changes that reality. The Palestinians are not going to go away. They are not going to give up their resistance. They may go through periods of more feeble resistance. They may go through periods of uprisings. We don't know. We cannot predict it. But this remains the main Israeli issue of legitimacy and moral validity, not whether the Arab world accepts it or doesn't accept it. And that lack of moral validity will continue to inform what many good people in the world think about Israel, what many Muslims in the world think about Israel, and many Arabs think about Israel. And the last layer, I think it's very important to understand that in the Arab world, we have seen it during the Arab Spring, regimes very rarely represent what their civil societies want. It's very most difficult in the Emirates to talk about society and regime. It's kind of a bit of an artificial state. But in Bahrain, we know for sure that what the public opinion in Bahrain thinks about Palestine. We are familiar with the history of the solidarity in Bahrain with the Palestinian struggle going back to the 1950s. Yes, you can impose your will on a society as an authoritarian regime, but that doesn't mean you represent that society. And altogether, if and when the process of democratization from below, not from above, from below in the Arab world would be reignited, despite everything that happened after the Arab Spring, it will include also a demand from the rulers, governments, and regimes to take a far more proactive role in supporting the Palestinian and their struggle.
You told Al Jazeera that American support for Israel comes more from non-Jews than Jews. And I'm going to just quote you. In the Democratic Party, they are pro-Israeli because of the success of the Israeli lobby. In the Republican Party, it has a lot to do with Christian Zionism. So what's your take? Is there any hope coming out of the U.S. For human rights in Palestine? I mean, I'm involved, you know, with Jeff, and we're an activist organization here, and there are more and more activist organizations. But on any kind of level, what's your take on what's coming out of the U.S. in terms of Palestinian support?
Well, what we said about the Arab world, I think, is true about the United States as well. We should distinguish between a regime in many ways and a civil society. I'm never taken a determinist teleological view on American position. I know, for instance, quite well the period of the Kennedy administration. A very interesting, even before that, the Eisenhower administration. Although the policies of both these presidents towards progressive Arab regimes was nothing to write home about, they took quite a moral position on the Palestinian refugee question. In fact, AIPAC was founded because there was a sense, especially during the years of the Eisenhower administration, but it continued into the Kennedy administration, that Israel is unable to change a basic American position on the inevitability of the right of return of the refugees. I don't know how many people know it. And in 1960, in fact, we know that David Ben-Gurion, as Prime Minister of Israel, pressured Israeli academia to manipulate facts and produce a scholarly narrative that Israel had nothing to do with the refugees in an attempt to convince the Kennedy administration not to go to the United Nations and ask for a more assertive demand from Israel to return the refugees. So history teach, I don't want to go too deeply into that historical incident, as interesting as it is. But what it means is that things can change, first of all, at the regime level, for various reasons. Not all of them always altruistic and positive, but they can change. You know, an economic crisis in America can also undermine American support for Israel. Secondly, the younger generation of all religions and persuasions in the United States, I noticed, I may be wrong, especially those who eventually meet in the universities, in the campuses around America, seem to understand, if they have a modicum of decency in them, that supporting Israel is an immoral thing to do. And some of them don't do much with that revelation. Quite a few of them do a lot with that. And this is one of the reasons that Israeli diplomats don't like to go to American universities anymore. Yes, they're fighting back. They're trying to censor the campuses again on the question of Palestine. I'm not saying that the battle is over, but it shows you that there's something to battle against. And what they're battling against is that the younger generation of the United States, those who care about African-American rights, those who care about Native American rights, those who care about women's rights, people who are conscientious members of society and who are troubled by injustice in the United States are people that Israel will not be able to recruit anymore. And I think, therefore, there are undercurrents in American society which make me hopeful. I fully understand that they have not reached the Congress or the level of the government or even mainstream media. But you can see some, you know, kind of harbingers, one can call them, of a different era to come, whether these are the three brave women who sits in the House of Representatives, articles like those by Peter Baynard in the New York Times. Not everything is my position, but it just, even Bernie Sanders as a candidate, as a powerful candidate. These are all, I think, indications that there is there a potential for a different American position. I don't know exactly when it will unfold, but I would not give up on a different American position in the future.
Ilan, for many of us, your seminal Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine uncovered so much rich historical material for our activism. It's required reading for anyone taking up the cause for Palestinian rights, I think. One page after the other details how the Ethnic Cleansing Project of Israel was, from the start, a coordinated long-range policy ordered at the highest levels of government. Tell us what led to your research, and were you surprised by anything that you learned?
Yes. Well, it started by a choice of becoming a professional historian and do a doctorate in history. I understood that if I want to work in a more free environment, I should leave Israel for the PhD, and I went to Oxford. I also took a kind of a conscious decision to be supervised by an Arab supervisor if I want really to see things from different from the way I was seeing them before I came to England. So it started with kind of a typical PhD based on archival material that began to be released on 48. But when I started the PhD and I published it, and I came back to Israel, and then I learned that there were other historians like Benny Morris working on that period. And we all found a lot of things that we didn't know about and were contradictory to what we were told. Even at that stage, I think we all of us assumed that this is what happens in a war. People are being kicked out. People are getting massacred. But I think at the first stage of my career as an academic, I didn't see the connection between that and any substantial fundamental issues with the state in which I was living and its ideology. What really changed my mind and really sent me back to research on 48 in 2000, and it took me 7 years to publish the book Ethnic Cleansing in 2007, was the second uprising. And it's the second uprising in 2000 spilled into Israel. And the level of racism, the willingness of the Israeli police to kill unarmed Palestinian citizens of Israel, for me was a wake-up call. And I began to see the picture in a different way. I understood that it was not a history of exceptional brutality here and there, but there was an inherent brutality. There was inherent racism in the project. I was also lucky that in the late 1990s, Israel released a lot of documents it did not release in the 70s, mainly military documents. And that really complemented the picture. And I think more importantly for me was not just uncovering what many Palestinians knew anyway, what happened in 48, but what was the result of a world that was indifferent to what Israel did, in fact was silent about what Israel did. What was the price Palestinians paid after 1948 for that global, especially Western, moral position? And that meant that since the ethnic cleansing was incomplete in 1948, Israel could continue with it in different means and different modes until today. So I think that was part of of the kind of background for the project.
The ongoing Nakba.
Absolutely, absolutely.
In your book, 10 Myths About Israel, you begin this way. History lies at the core of every conflict. A true and unbiased understanding of the past offers the possibility of peace. The distortion or manipulation of history will only sow disaster. Then you go on to say, the Zionist historical account is based on a cluster of myths. So I want you to talk about two of the myths that you listed. First of all, Zionism is not colonialism. Mm-hmm. And the second one, Zionism is the only democracy in the Middle East.
Yeah. The first myth is always something that bewildered me, because as a historian, I read a lot of the early Zionist documents, speeches, letters, public appearances. And there is not one Zionist leader that does not try to convince leaders in the West to support Zionism who is not using the term colonialism in order to make sure that people would support them. And the early Zionist institution include a colonial bank, colonies, colonization, whether they spoke in Yiddish, German, Hebrew, or English or French, the word that they were using to describe what they're going to do in Palestine was colonization and building colonies. So I understand that the PR of colonialism has changed over the years, but there's no way of taking it out of history. Zionism was a colonialist project first and foremost in the eyes of the Zionist leaders. Secondly, due to great developments in the research, academic research in recent years, and even longer than recent years, we came across a more fine-tuning of the term colonialism, which is settler colonialism, which enabled us to understand how can a colonialist project exist if it doesn't have a mother country, a metropole, which was the main counter-argument against people who said, well, how can you say Zionism was colonialism? There was no Britain or France. There was its mother country that sent the colonialists. And indeed, settler colonialism, as we know from the United States, among other places, is a phenomenon of Europeans who are being chased out of Europe or flee out of Europe because they are persecuted or because they fear for their life or whatever reason, and do not believe that they can stay in Europe and try to recreate a Europe on someone else's homeland. And that is what they're using, are the same means of colonialism. In fact, quite a lot of scholars of settler colonialism claim that settler colonialism is even more brutal than colonialism, because colonialism wants to exploit the native, whereas settler colonialism, as we know from the United States, wants to get rid of the native population. In North America, this was translated into genocide. In Palestine, it was translated, and still is translated, into ethnic cleansing.
And the second one, Zionism is the only
second myth,
at least.
Yeah. The second myth is another kind of exercise I did for myself, and I'm sure I'm not the only one. I took the most benign and conventional definition of democratic states, even those which were not very complementary to democracy, but sort of gave us idea of what a democracy looks like, even not an ideal type democracy, it's a normal democracy. And none of these fit the reality in which for more than 50 years, there are millions of people without basic human rights and civil rights, just because they are Palestinians who live in the West Bank, or are sieged in a ghetto in the Gaza Strip. They are, even if they have the right to vote and be elected inside Israel, are barred from living in towns and certain settlements, are discriminated against, not because of what they do, but because of who they are. It's very difficult to see any country in the world that is regarded in political science as democracy falling into this a category. So I think that Israel is not a democracy in that sense. It is a bit of a democratic master race democracy, as people used to call apartheid South Africa, where there were certain democratic mechanisms for the white community to elect their leaders and so on, but the rest of the non-white community did not enjoy the fruits of that democracy. And this, if you combine the two myths together, by the way, that Israel is a settler colonial state and it's not a democracy, you can understand why it's easy for Israel, relatively easy for Israel, to sell part of the puzzle without showing the rest of the puzzle and saying, this is democratic. Go and visit Tel Aviv, a groovy democratic city. See, meet Palestinian members of Knesset. How can you say that we are not a democracy? I mean, there are definitely sections and features of the society which are democratic in nature, but they don't undermine the non-democratic apartheid identity and nature of the state as a whole.
You know, this idea of these myths, there's so many levels to this, Ilan. Everything from disinformation campaigns to American talking points to the Ministry of Hasbara, to the erasing of Palestinian culture, villages, and more. Talk to us a little bit about disinformation, about Hasbara, and the erasure of Palestinian culture.
Yes, part of any settler colonial project is to appropriate the history of the native, so to speak, and expunge the indigenous population from the history of the country. It begins with building Jewish settlements over destroyed Palestinian villages in 1948 and giving them the names of the Palestinian village, but in a Hebrew version. So Safuria becomes Tzipori, Lubia becomes Lavi. The reason is to say that actually originally this was a biblical village that was usurped by force by the Palestinians. Of course, there's no historical, this is so bizarre as a historical statement that it doesn't deserve really going into it. But it's one side of the fabrication. It continues with a very intensive work in the Israeli Foreign Ministry to prepare a narrative of the Palestinians leaving voluntarily their homes in which they lived for hundreds of years. As if the Palestinians are marathon runners who like just one day to take everything they have and run away. But Israeli academia was recruited to sell this lie about a society which was not really attached to the land, and that's why it was very easy to convince them to leave. So Israel has no responsibility for it, denying, of course, the systematic expulsion we were talking about. And then there is the whole issue of security and rights. If you try to educate the world that an indigenous native people, like the Palestinians, are terrorists in potential, and therefore everything you do to them is justified, either because they committed the terrorist act or they will commit the terrorist act. And the world does not expose this cynical, insidious idea. You can see how this fabrication is working to the level of a TV series like Fauda that Netflix is producing in the United States. It is an amazing kind of success, which I hope is now losing its validity, to portray the Palestinians as immigrants, first of all, who should behave well in their host country, where actually the host country immigrated into the people. And secondly, because they are immigrants who are involved in the liberation struggle, they are irresponsible immigrants, ungrateful immigrants. Israeli experts are invited all over Europe to participate in meetings of how to deal with the Muslim immigration into Europe, as if Israel is also a country facing Muslim immigration. We need to expose these impossible associations and links that are being done and are part of this web of lies and fabrications I was talking about.
You're a supporter of BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. Talk to us about the various levels at which BDS is working. What are some of its most recent successes, and what more needs to be done?
Yeah, I think, first of all, the BDS is really a tough dialogue with the Israeli society, but a very necessary one, because every other means to stop the brutal oppression of the Palestinians has failed so far. And I think it's a young process, so to speak. So it's too premature to assess whether it will be as effective as we hope it will be. It has some successes, already some notable successes, and I will point to some of them. One, it galvanized solidarity with the Palestinians at a time where it was difficult for solidarity movements to understand who represents the Palestinians, how does the solidarity group react to disunity in the camp in which it's supposed to help. And it gave a very consensual way of working above the issues of one state or two states or Hamas or Fatah. And I think that was one very important achievement. Secondly, it created the direct link between the civil society in occupied Palestine and inside Israel and the solidarity movement. Sometimes these links before were through mediators. Now I think there's much more direct, intimate link. And solidarity is based on you hear what people want you to do. You don't tell them what to do. And I think this effect of the BDS emerges as an initiative of the civil society is very helpful to make the solidarity movement more authentic and more useful, I think. And then there are the successes in the universities. I think we're beginning to see not just a lot of activism on the campuses, which recruits a lot of young people who were not there before on the Palestine issue, but even influencing curricula of courses and modules, teaching plans. Unthinkable things are happening, like teaching Palestine in a module or course on colonialism, or on ethnic cleansing, or even on genocide studies. This was unheard of before, and I think these will have long-term effects of on the population. And then there are some of the economic successes, convincing trade union churches to divest and to limit action of some of the multinational corporation from being involved in the occupation and assisting it. And finally, contrary to what some of our friends warned us, in fact, the BDS increased the number of Israeli academics supporting it rather than objecting it. I can prove it very easily. When we started as a group of Israeli academics who responded to the call on BDS from the Palestinian society, we were six or seven people. The numbers are much higher now. And for the first time, we hear Israeli academics who are presidents of universities or provosts expressing at least some concern on the lack of academic freedom in the occupied territory, something they have never done before. So I think that these are influences that only time will tell when they will fuse together into a powerful wave, how important they were if we get to that point where really the reality on the ground will change fundamentally.
Talk to us about the Palestinian right of return. You call it part of a blueprint for restorative justice for the Palestinian people.
Yes, I think for me it's very clear that this is a precondition for any genuine reconciliation in Palestine. First of all, the principled recognition in the right of return. Before I'm talking about how practically it can be implemented, I think that only through an international recognition, and in the end of the day, an Israeli recognition of the Palestinian right of return, we can understand that the moral basis for a future solution has been laid. As I say, there are many practical issues with it, but to begin with, it has to be the basis for any idea of reconciliation, because that means that the ongoing Nakba, as we called it, the ongoing ethnic cleansing has come to an end, that there is a closure, and that you are rectifying the past, the evils of the past, which do not only include return, by the way. They would include the redistribution of natural resources, such as land, giving up on privileges that the Jewish society has today, and granting equal rights to everyone who lives there and everybody who comes back. So it's part, for me, it's part of a larger idea of restorative justice and reconciliation. But I think that, you know, if for 50 years experts around the world were involved in finding out what is the best solution through the paradigm of a two-state solution that totally ignored the right of return, we could have used those 50 years to work out, I'm sure we would have succeeded in working out how in practical means how to implement the right of return. And by the way, this is not exceptional. Sometimes refugee problems are solved by resettlement, but there are quite a few examples of repatriation, and there are United Nations mechanisms for repatriation that take care of the rights, not just of the refugees, but the people who live in their homes, the people who live on their fields. We don't have, contrary to what people think, we don't have to invent the wheel. We just have to accept that there are universal principles that allow millions of people to come back to a homeland from which they were forcefully removed. They and their families, should they want to do this. We don't know how many would want to do this, how many would want to come back permanently, but this is not the issue now. The issue now is to say this is a sacred individual right of every Palestinian refugee, which is beyond the question of the political regime that would replace the present one. This is above it. It's kind of a meta issue without which you cannot believe, the Palestinians will not believe that they have a genuine partner for reconciliation on the other side.
You write in The Forgotten Palestinians about Palestinians living within Israel. The perception of the Palestinians as unwanted and unwelcome has remained a potent part of Zionist discourse and attitude in what became Israel in 1948. Then you go on to say, they're a heterogeneous community, Christians, Muslims, Islamists, secularists, and more, living side by side with each other as a minority community. And further, you're right, theirs is an amazing story of almost impossible navigation in a sea of colonialism, chauvinist nationalism, fanatic religiosity, and international indifference. So talk to us more about these forgotten Palestinians.
Yeah. Yes, this particular paragraph was written with genuine emotion, because I have, since I'm, And I spend a lot of my time in Israel, as well as in the UK, and I have very few Jewish friends, I have to say the truth, not surprisingly, maybe. And I have many Palestinian friends, and I feel very much part of the community, not as a Palestinian Israeli, but as a Palestinian Jewish. And I'm surprised at the humanity that exists there, and the impulse that is still there to live, to find a peaceful reconciliation with the Jews, and understanding that there could be a good future for both people if only Zionism would be removed as the ideology of the regime, and it's all done in most cases on the basis of humanity, universal values, and so on, and I'm very impressed when this is still a basic attitude under such harsh conditions that I mentioned. This community, we have to remember, this community was under a harsh military rule until 1966, which those of you who are familiar with the evils of military rule in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip would know what it looks like. But it looked like this for the Palestinians and Israel. Things got better after 67, but on a daily basis and an individual basis, some of the experiences remind us of the still experiences of African Americans today in the United States, which came to the fore in the encounters with the police. But some of it is very unique to a whole community that maybe the best example to explain it. Imagine if the affairs and future and status of the Jewish community in the United States would be handled only by the FBI. Imagine such a situation where people would say, you know, when it comes to American Jews, it's not the Ministry of Education, Ministry of Industry, you know, whoever, municipality. No, this is, you know, a potential fifth column. This is a potential enemy. So a decision who can be a teacher, who can work where they want to work, who can settle where they want to settle, who can move freely and who cannot move freely, en masse, as a group, not as individuals, is determined by the experts of internal security. Living under such precarious conditions is by itself a huge hardship. To this, one could add the fact that for a while, the Palestinian National Movement forgot about them as well. And the two-state solution also marginalized them as an issue. That's why the one state, the one democratic state campaign is so important, I think, for that particular community, because it wants to rearrange or reframe the relationship between Jews and Palestinians all over historical Palestine, not just in small part of it. So this is a very important community, a very impressive community that in many ways knows intimately both community and can easily foresee a different life with a Jewish community based on equality, maybe more than people in the West Bank who only know Israelis as settlers and soldiers. And I think that their history should be taught and their role should be far more significant in the liberation project of Palestine than it was until now.
One last question. You've been a relentless seeker of truth, of a true and honest rendering of history, even at great personal cost. What keeps you going? What inspires you and gives you hope that your work might play a role in building peace with justice?
Well, I think there are several things that allow someone like me, and I'm not, as you know, I'm not the only one. There's quite a few of us, not just in the case of Palestine, but around the world, thank God. I think that there are a few things that work here. One, there is a moment, and I wasn't able to define it for myself, but I know there was a moment where you sort of cross the Rubicon, you cross the river, and you know there's no way back. And actually, you feel very liberated when you understand that this is now what you're going to do, and you feel at peace with yourself for doing it. And that really is the best immunity shield from any hardships that you meet on the way. And I think that a lot of people who face injustice and decide to act against injustice have such a moment when they understand the price that they might pay for this, but the struggle becomes more important than the price. Secondly, I know that the price paid by my Palestinian friends is much higher, far, far much higher than I ever paid or would pay. And that gives me a lot of strength to see their steadfastness, their courage, and their commitment. And I'm very much inspired by them and their action and way of acting towards the the predicaments that faces them. And finally, I think that I feel that actually for the sake of even the Israeli Jews, it's good that people like myself exist, because I think in the end of the day, it would make sure that the solution would be based on restitution and not retribution, that it gives hope to the Palestinian and Arab side that there are people who they can rely on, who they could live with and coexist and build together a different society. I think it's very important to have indicators for the oppressed people, the colonized, the persecuted, that there are people with a different take that originally are part of the privileged oppressor, the society of the oppressor. Looking at history, I know that this kind of presence was very important in the more successful reconciliation process that followed years of colonization or dictatorship or long periods of abuses of human and civil rights.
You have been listening to Israeli historian Ilan Pape in conversation with Dr. Michael Spath. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم